This is an interview with Larry Austin Nowland. We're in Fernandina Beach, Florida, and this is March 26th, 2009. And this is an account of his father's experience in World War II. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay.
This is my father, Denver Austin Nowland. He was born January 13th, 1914. He served with the Army Air Force from February the 27th, 1942 to September 1945. He was a side gunner on a B-17 and also was an airplane maintenance technician. He flew on with two planes, LARP and LU, and the Brennan Circus, both with the same pilot, who was Joseph Brennan, a 21-year-old lieutenant from Germantown, Pennsylvania. Here's one thing that was sent out after the attack of a ball bearing factory. I'm going to read exactly what it says here. The valiant effort of the 8th Air Force Flying Fortress pilot, 1st Lieutenant Joseph Brennan of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and the crew of Brennan's Circus is to bring in their battered bomber back from Siegfried, Germany, on one remaining engine was described today. Crossing parts of Belgium and Holland on two engines, flying as low as that the crewmen could see the open mouths of civilians in the streets and fields cheering and waving them on, the fort had the third engine knocked out from fire from enemy ground troops as it passed the coast. The only remaining engine tried but failed to carry the bomber across the North Sea at its low altitude. The ship finally hit the water just 5 miles from the East English coast. Brennan and his crew were rescued and reached England intact. Following their repercussions period in the 8th Air Force rest home, the flyers told the details of the battle and the struggle to bring the Circus back. The first engine was shot out about 10 minutes before the target was reached. In the raising enemy attacks, fighter attacks, the engine was hit and set on fire. After 5 minutes of futile struggle to keep the rest of the formation, the 21-year-old pilot and his co-pilot, 2nd Lieutenant Gordon F. White, 22 of Parsons, Kansas, decided that their only chance was to lay and lighten their load. The bombardier, 2nd Lieutenant Joseph N. Green, 24 of Buena Vista, Macon, Georgia, was told to drop his bomb before reaching the target. Just the bomb's base mechanism, too, had been hit and put out of commission. The bombs didn't fall. It was decided right then that we peeled off the pilot and were far behind the rest of the formation, and the fighters were making a terrible pass at us. They were 25,000 feet and swung over and let her go. Shaking and shivering, the fort went down to a dive at 350 miles an hour. The German fighters, convinced they found a victim, followed in dove, slugging their shells and rockets at it. Staff Sergeant Willard Winsell, 23-year-old rodeo operator, gunner from Anderson, Pennsylvania, flying on his 25th mission, had one of the worst moments of his combat just then. The pilot kept wiring and went down, and the fighters kept on coming on their tail. It didn't take long for them to know that they were falling off. He said, I was all alone in the radio compartment. I didn't have any headset on. I thought the wings were falling off. The pilot had ordered us to bail out and hadn't heard him. I opened the radio compartment door and looked to see if the bomb doors were open. They were. I thought that I was left all alone in the plane. At controls, that really hit me. I turned to ice. I fumbled around, finally managed to plug in my headset and call the pilot. There was a minute before he answered. I kept holding my breath. And then he said, stick with us, babe. Stick with us. The bombardier, in the meantime, finally succeeded in releasing the bombs. The ship leveled off, and navigator Lieutenant Vern Virto of Beaumont, Texas, received the fix from the radio man Winsell and set a course for home. The pilot In a last desperate effort to shake, the German pursuit brought the bomber down within 15 feet of the ground. The fighters finally turned back. Lieutenant Brennan maintained his low attitude with only 2 inches left, hedge hopping so low fields and freakily he could lift his wings over the treetops or rooftop. This time the Brennan circus reached Holland and Belgium. The worst of the air attacks had passed, except as it passed over small airdromes. The fort was just not fired upon. The crew finally see the civilians and inhabitants of the occupied territory waving, cheering, and holding V for victory salutes. Near the coast, however, they ran into a heavy barrage of fire from the enemy ground. They fired everything at us, said Staff Sergeant Denver Nallen, 29 of Longview, Texas. The right waist gunner. They were so close to us, there was nothing more terrifying. The radio operator Wetzel sent out an identifying signal to the English coast, thinking that the ship would come back capable of sinking, but a few minutes later, the lieutenant called back and prepared to ditch. Despite all could be done, the circus finally went down. The men's controls, teamwork, settled the riddled bomber smoothly on the water only 5 miles from land. It was some landing, said the turret gunner. We came as smoothly as we were landing on a runway. Didn't even get my feet wet. Short time later, they were picked up and brought safely home. Here's a quote from my father. One of the most exciting days of my life. Wouldn't take $1 million for it, for the experience, but I would do it again for $2 million. And that's my father.
What year was that, Larry?
1943. My father was in the 8th Air Force. In one raid, their one plane shot down 9 fighters, ME-109s and Fokker Wolfs. My father, all through the war, was finally accredited with 4.5 kills. He was almost an ace, which is really unusual for a side gunner. My father got the Distinguished Service Cross. He got a Bronze Star. This is the Air Medal.
Okay.
And he got this with 3 oak leaf clusters, which means he was awarded 3 times. He got the Bronze Star twice with 2 oak leaf clusters. This is a Service Medal right here.
Uh-huh.
And so you also got the unit citation, but we don't have that medal and we don't have the Bronze Star. But here is what would be his air medals, Distinguished Flying Cross, and Bronze Star medals. And like I say, this was my father. All right.
Very nice.
We're done.
Thank you.
All right.
All right, my name is Ann Smith, and I represent the Sam Proctor Oral History Program at the University of Florida in Gainesville, Florida.
Julia now.
Julian. I'm sorry.
Julia. I'm sorry.
And it's March 26th, 2009, and we are going to begin by going through some of the pictures and memorabilia that Julia has kept from her mother's service. Tell me first, what year was she born?
My mother was born Constance Mitty Young in Americus, Georgia, in November 17, 1921.
And she entered the service what year?
Well, she entered the service, that's a great question, in 1942.
All right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Why don't you walk us around to see some of her things and tell us about her?
Okay. Absolutely. This is a panel that was made by her grandchildren, which was a memorial to her at her funeral. But it does have some great photographs of her. This is my mother in her flight outfit with her flight coat when she was a women's air service pilot in World War II. Here she is with several of her comrades and Miss Cochran, who started the Women's Air Service Pilots. Being raised in Tallahassee, we spent a lot of time down at the beach, and this is mother with some of her great comrades down at Alligator Point. That would be my godmother, Frenchie Proctor, and Miss Hefner, and Miss Teague. Mother was also, after aviation, she was married in 1945 to my father, and they married and had five children. But in 1952, she began playing golf. So she was a very early golfer and played up until almost the day before her death. And she met many, many women who were on the golf circuit because she grew with the circuit. And so we, of course, have many pictures of her at different courses all around, involved in different golf outings. She was also an avid horseback rider, and we have a picture of her on horses from almost every year. Let me just move right along here. This is her first great-grandson, Nicholas, who was actually here to see her when she died. And so this is the Women's Air Service Pilots album, which shows the pictures. This is their yearbook. Shows all the pictures of the WASP and the different women and the different classes. Now, Mother's class was class 43-7, and that means it was in 1943 in July. So that may help you if you're not familiar with military lingo, and I certainly wasn't when I started doing these programs. Now, you may be very curious about the front of the album. Well, this is Fifi Nella, and it always comes with the Walt Disney logo. But the insider story is that one of the WASP was dating one of his artists, one of his illustrators, and that he did this just sort of for fun, and Walt saw it, and Janet Cochran had asked for them to have a mascot. And so all was agreed by all parties that this would just be the perfect one. So she comes embossed on this cover, and she comes in color on some other items, which I'll share with you right now, since we're on that subject. They used her for many of the reunion covers. And she's on everything. You can't get away from her, and she's just adorable. I will tell you this, that the Women's Air Service Pilots just held their last reunion at Avenger Field in Sweetwater last year. That would be 2008. And so with that disbandment, we're not sure what the copyright on using this will be, if it will continue. That's a question that I just found out about at Keystone Heights at the air show there. Wings of Dreams, which organization flew in 41 Women's Air Service Pilots to the last reunion on volunteer time on B-17s and military aircraft. So they're a wonderful organization. This is a picture of my mother. I should probably start and tell you. Oh, we're going to do the walkthrough. I'm sorry. So here is a banner that was used in the parades. When Mother moved here in the late 1980s to Amelia Island, Florida, first thing she did was go down to see the veterans. And they have a little log cabin on Atlantic Avenue. And they didn't have any female members, so they welcomed her with open arms and asked her if she would like to be in the Veterans Day Parade, that she would just be the perfect person. And of course she said yes. And so they would always have her convertible with this sign on the sides. And here is a picture of her in the parade every year.
Wonderful. Did she just love that?
Did she like it? Sure, she loved it. We were always in the parades because we were FSU booster people, and You know, and I'm DAR. Everybody wants to be in the parade here. It's a little town. These pictures here, of course, are from Avenger Field, these black and whites. And I have many, many, many photos of Mother. Here she is in, full uniform. And, a little interesting tidbit about these uniforms. Janet Cochran, when it came down to for them to have a uniform, there wasn't a uniform, had gone to Hap Arnold, who started the WASP, and she had on her uniform, and he said, "Well, I don't know, we have some OD green in the warehouse, an entire bolt." Well, she did appease him and went out and looked at it, but she knew she wasn't going to use it. So she went out shopping to find this Santiago blue. And she had two uniforms made, and she put one on a military person, and she put one on a French model, and she won her wore her own. And they all marched into Hap Arnold's office, and he really didn't care for either the French model or the military lady, but he loved hers. And he said, "I would like yours made for these women." And she said, "Well, you can't, because mine was made in Paris," because she had flown in England. And so then he chose the French model. So Bergdorf Goodman designed the uniform. And when it was time for the uniforms to be fitted, the tailors and the seamstresses from Neiman Marcus out of Dallas went over to Sweetwater to Avenger Field and custom fit them. So when I finish telling you all the horrible things that happened to them, you will know that Nancy Cochran was truly a hero in at least getting this part accomplished. So that's a little tidbit about the uniforms that I don't think very many people know. Mm-hmm. This was my mother in later years living here. Oh, this is a better picture even here. Some of this really should go with the story. But when Mother was accepted to be a Women's Air Service pilot, this is the original newspaper article, this was her picture. What we'll do maybe is... like that. Okay. And you'll notice on this article that they have WAFs. Well, that's because when these women were first accepted into this program, they didn't have a name for the program. And then here's Mother holding up this article at one of the many interviews that she did for local magazines, newspapers. I have a ton of them. Put this back over here. And as you can see, it was very popular back then. Coca-Cola certainly picked right up on it. So Coca-Cola and Walt Disney, they knew what was happening here. This was announced that they were going to have this picture made, and if you can see, it's of Avenger Field, and you can see the wishing well and the barracks and everything. But Betty Jo Reed had an occasion to meet Rick Broom, and he was a famous painter. So she had she sent an aerial picture of Sweetwater given to her by Fran Tuskman. With the AT-6 U-222, which was their training plane. And as you can see, there is a Women's Air Service pilot in there. This picture was actually made, and then numbered prints were sold. The original was damaged and is no longer around. So I think we have 135 out of 1,500. So That was something they did sort of as a fundraiser. They were always trying to raise money for, as the women got older and they had reunions, some weren't able to come for different reasons, and so. Well, let's see, I'll keep walking around here. This was the original blouse. As you can see, it's pretty worn. Now, I have read where the original blouse was white, and it may have been. They had several uniforms. I mean, they had their dress uniform, and this may have been used for something else. I've really never gotten a clear idea, but this was, you can look at this and tell this is from that, and she's always kept this. And here is their mechanic suit, their zoot suit, their parachute suit, their overalls. They didn't have women's sizes. They only had men's sizes. So they were always in these great big things. And one of the things that was really nice and handy was all these women knew how to sew. And whenever they had time off, you would see in many of the barrack pictures that I have that they're sitting there with needle and thread. This is the pilot
helmet.
Yeah. Hood, the leather. This is the original one. And I know that back in that era, a lot of women for entertainment tapped. So these are her original tap shoes in the original box. And I remember very vividly as I was growing up that she always wanted us to tap. And then occasionally she'd whip these out and put them mm-hmm. on. My son, Larry Austin Nallen Jr., he goes by Austin, went to Fernandina Beach High School. And he was in 11th grade, I believe, when he did this interview. One of their assignments was to interview someone that they admire. And so he chose his grandmother. The interview was to be done in first person, and so actually this is in first person, and I would like to read it to you. This is her story in first person, if I may. Constance Young Reynolds, Women's Air Service Pilot 43-7. I was born November 17, 1921 in America, Georgia, to Thomas Sutton Young and Mabel Mitty Tripp. My earliest memories of aviation was going to Southernfield in Americas to see the planes. Lindbergh learned how to fly at Southernfield. My family moved to Atlanta the year I started school, and my father became an early employee of Eastern Air Transport, which later became Eastern Airlines. Captain Eddie Rickenbacker was president of Eastern, and I used to see him at company parties. I also saw Amelia Earhart take off from Old Miami International Airport at Opa-locka on her last flight. Eastern had moved from Atlanta to Miami in 1936. An interesting fact is June Speck Drew, class 43-7, Gwendolyn Coart Hickerson, class 43-4, and I all graduated from Joe E. Jr. High School in Atlanta, Georgia in 1936. Upon graduation from Andrew Jackson High School, Miami, Florida, 1939, first class, she has that in parentheses, I got a job with Paul E. Scheip Steel Company and then with Emory Riddle School of Aviation as secretary to the purchasing agent. We were very busy as Emory Riddle had contracts with 5 primary flying schools. I served as temporary purchasing agent at the school in Union City, Tennessee, until a permanent replacement could be found. While employed with Emory Riddle, I took flying lessons and soloed in September 1941. My instructors were Helen Cavis Ferber and Mary Hall Brooks. I entered the WASP program, arriving in Sweetwater, Texas by train from Miami May 26, 1943. My training there consisted of the following: primary PT, 1955 hours, basic PT, 13, 65 hours, advanced AT-6 and AT-17, twin engine, 60 hours. After graduation in November 1943, I had a few weeks off, so I got rides on Air Force planes to Miami to see my family. I had to report to the basic flying school in Chico, California, so I caught a ride on a B-17 to San Bernardino. Well, the only place they had for me on the plane was in the nose of the Norden bomb site. So I had a great view of the country on this first trip to the far west. Kay Clevis and I were the first two women pilots stationed at Chico, and Colonel Hall, the commanding officer, had us housed in the nurses' quarters. As Moore Walsh came to Chico, he made the bottom floor of one of the bachelor's officers' quarters available to us and the American Red Cross representation stationed there. While at Chico, I did engineering test flying and administrative flying. From Chico, I was sent to Minsterfield, Bakersfield, California, which as an advanced flying school with AT-6s. As the first woman pilots there, we had to telegram Miss Cochran regarding the mother. In the interim, we had to find housing in town and rides to get to work at the base. We finally did get housing, and then I was sent on TDY to headquarters. Western Flying Training Command at Santa Ana, California. At Santa Ana, Dorothy Moulton and I were to visit the WASP bases and make new assignments to other bases. When TDY was over in Santa Ana, I was stationed at Yuma Air Base, Yuma, Arizona, to train in B-26s to tow targets for B-17 gunners. At this time, the program was going to close soon, and I returned to Sweetwater for instrument training, even though I was instrument rated. I returned to Albany, Georgia from my WASP adventure, and I got a job as secretary to the communications officer at Turner Air Force Base. On November the 2nd, 1945, I married George Spears Reynolds, Jr. I became a housewife and a mother. I had five children, Marie, Jamie, George III, Julia, Thomas. Also, I have nine lovely grandchildren. My husband and I divorced in 1977, and I returned to work with the Internal Revenue Service. I had worked as a realtor and tax preparer. I am an avid golfer, and I have played golf for 50 years, and I still am still active with local golf associations. I served as Region 1 Director for the Women's Air Service Pilot from 1997 to 1998, and it was on the board with Vi Cowden as president. I belong to the Women's Military Aviators, Civil Air Patrol, American Legion, 99s, and several golf associations. My son, George Reynolds III, is the Chief Judge in the Second Judicial Circuit of Tallahassee, Florida. My son, Thomas, is deceased. My daughter, Jamie, is a librarian, and my daughter, Julia, is a decorator. Out of my nine grandchildren, I have two that are in college and one that will start college in the fall. I have one great-grandchild named David Nicholas Sparks. So that's her first-person bio, and this gives me a great entrance to kind of tell you about this. As growing up, we did not know anything about this. We had no clue. When mother and daddy got married, you know, you just had those five kids pretty quick. She had five under six, so she was busy. And time goes on. We did move from Albany, Georgia to Tallahassee, Florida. She was in the Air Force Reserves up until 1952 at Turner Field. So we moved to Tallahassee, and life just starts rolling on. We never really had a clue about this until much later in life, when we would go different places and mother would say, oh, well, I'm going to go and see my friend, or my friend's going to come and see me. And we would say, well, we don't know this friend. Why don't we know your friends? And she would say, oh, well, this is somebody that I was a pilot with. Well, we didn't know anything about World War II. And so once Mother moved over here to Amelia in the late 1980s, well, it was just all the rage. Everybody wanted her just to do nothing but tell stories about it. And I became very educated and wanted to know more. And so she started showing me more and sharing more with me. And that's where I found out that she had kept her original uniform in just mint condition. I mean, this is really an exceptional condition for the uniform, with her original hat, which is very rare, I understand. And then the jumpsuit and this blouse. The tap shoes are just, they're a bonus. How cool is that? Many things that she had that are I never show in my programs, and that is her original pilot log. It's just priceless, and it just has everything logged in that she's ever done. These are really hard to come by with their aviation maps. And I have her original issue sunglasses. and this is what she would have to wear with her. The Air Corps Reserve Army of the United States. This was her certification card. And when you open it up, there it is with her dog tags. And that's my dad and her before they were married. So these were the little goodies that she carried around with her all the time. One of the... also, here is her flight meter. This is, I don't know the exact thing, but this is what measures. I don't know if I can get it out of here. Oh, well, anyway, it measures how far you've gone. It has a metal wheel in there. I just don't know very much about this equipment. So after Mother had passed away, and I'd seen a lot of these things in some of the photos because I had started to meet a lot of her friends like Caddy Steele in Gainesville, and I gotten to know some of her friends. It was just as nice for me to go and have a cocktail with them as it was for her to go. I mean, you know, it was fun. And they would talk about old times. After her death, and I was cleaning out her house, This is an Air Force Service issue for the Wasp, a little metal suitcase. And I opened it up, and in here, and this is just a few of the envelopes, was every letter that my father, during the war, 1993, 94, and 95, every love letter he had ever written her.
1945.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. From 43, I have two books on 45, and they've all been, my brother, I do the Thanksgiving for the family, was here 2 years ago, and we sat down with the suitcase. I have a picture of us sitting in here doing this, and went and got the acid-free paper, and we now have them all archived, and we have read them. And this is such a wonderful insight to his side, because I have so little on my father. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of men don't keep things. But my mother kept her the love letters. Mm-hmm. And so these letters speak 1,000 words. Mm-hmm. And so I have four albums, and they're just priceless. And it really tells you a lot about the war and where they were. And he was Air Force Intelligence. So a lot of the letters say somewhere in the Pacific. Mm-hmm. And I did want to just share this with you. And this is my own personal tribute to my mother. And I really like this. I think it's just so perfect. And of course, it starts out with the 10 greatest women. And of course, it's 11 women now, but it starts off with Coco Chanel, Sarah Bernhardt, Amelia Earhart, the Honorable Margaret Thatcher, Annie Oakley, Susan B. Anthony, Florence Nightingale, Eleanor Roosevelt, Evita Maria Perón, Betsy Ross, and of course, Connie Reynolds.
And how did that come about? Is that something you collected?
Yes.
And you framed it for her?
Well, it was for her. I gave it to her for Mother's Day. But it's back with me now. So it just sort of says it all.
Oh, yes, it does. Yes, it does. My name is Ann Smith, and I'm with the Sam Proctor Oral History Program at the University of Florida in Gainesville, Florida. It's March 26, 2009, and I'm in the home of Julia Nowland, and we are continuing an interview after having seen some of the memorabilia that she has of her mother, who was in military service as a pilot in World War II. You were continuing from where we were telling stories about your relationship and that you didn't know all that much about your father, but you said you had learned so much about him as well as what was going on at that period of time from his letters to your mother during World War II.
That's correct.
Want to tell us some of that?
Well, I want to step back just a moment. One of the areas I didn't talk to you about was when the Women's Air Service Pilots were disbanded, which was in 1945. It was very sudden. It was in November, and they were disbanded in December, just before Christmas, and they were simply told to go home with their own money, the best way they could. So that's what they did. And so for many years, there was no communication between the girls. Some went this way, some went that way. Another interesting point is they were never recognized as veterans. It was in 1978 that they finally received veteran recognition. But still today, they don't have full veteran rights, mm-hmm. and it's still being worked on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I didn't talk about that before, but the women of this period and of this time did not talk about their military service, and it wasn't until my father was much older that he talked about his military service, and because I know all of us out there have heard the war stories over and over again. Because when they get older and they run into somebody else who was in World War II, then the stories just start flying. So Dad had attended Riverside Academy in Hollywood, Florida. And he attended the Citadel up mm-hmm. in Charleston.
Mm-hmm.
He and my mother actually had been friends for quite some time before the war broke out, because he had been at Riverside and she lived in Miami. So they had double dated and gone out quite a bit. So Dad went off to service and Mom was accepted into this program. I know that he also was in the Air Force, in the 5th Air Force. And from what I understand, the 5th Air Force was not based in the United States. It was, they were international bases, and there was quite a few. He started out in Fort Myers in what was Buckingham, and then moved around. He took a first sergeant position, was stationed at Buckingham. He applied for OCS school, and I'm just not exactly sure what all happened after that, but he was offered a different position and he took it, and was sent over to New Guinea, and was a lot of other places too. And a lot of these letters that I have 4 books of them. A lot of them say somewhere in the Pacific, and they couldn't write a lot of detail because it wouldn't get past the
censor.
The censor. There you go. I do have one letter that I do think is of particular interest because it pertains to him and to our family as far as a relative. Dear Connie, from the text of your letters, you seem to be having a hell of a boring time about all I've done since in the Army was hurry up and wait, or stayed in line. If when I get back to the States, every time I see a line of people, will probably automatically fall into it from loneliness. The longer you stay with or in the Army, the more of it you will change your opinion of it. Presumably, SNAFU. I don't know what that means. And that doesn't stand for fouled. If you're tired of being there, why don't you resign before being commissioned? Because after being commissioned, there is only one way to get out of it, and you can still type, smile, and flatter the boss. Sign up to be a stenographer and go to Alaska. From all reports, the girls up there seem to be having a pretty good time. That would be undoubtedly a better deal than going to Natal, Brazil. And I don't know where this is coming from. Or as a last resort, work in one of the large aircraft factories in or near Los Angeles. They all involve a good bit of effort, inconvenience, and being an Army wife as has its advantages. But after a while, it will also become boring. At any rate, you will offer new thrills for a while, and if you do take the stay, be sure and send me an invitation. I'm enclosing some Invasion Jap money that was used in Australia. Since leaving Australia, an arbitration having now gotten back into the war. I've gotten a darn good position, chief clerk of the A5, but knew that the administrative work would drive me nuts, so I am new in the Air Technical and Intelligence Unit, and this is okay since I don't care about the rank. This is Shop Talk. You probably this Shop Talk is probably very interesting, so we'll drop it for now. Just figured out up, and I have traveled 15,000 miles since last June, this time last year. Never thought I'd ever get around so much. Yesterday was Easter Sunday, and I don't recollect what we did that time last year or what was happening. Do you recollect? Heard one of your old favorites last night, Black Magic, and what a feeling it gives a person after not hearing it in many months. My thoughts the few I have are coming in spurts tonight, but thought of this. You could resign and go live with your Aunt May in Albany. It wouldn't be very hard to get a job at Turnerville, and as you know, Albany is a very lively place, and there's always something doing. Uncle Rob wrote me. Uncle Rob is his father's brother. That would be Senator Robert Rice Reynolds from Asheville, North Carolina. Uncle Rob wrote me and said that he thought he would run for president. Don't know what the hell he'll try next. He is sending me some, pinup girls. And I told him that would be an excellent way to get votes. As I told you once before, sent your mother and dad a sheepskin rug from Australia. but it will probably be several months before they get it. Well, that's it. Time for this to come to an end. So adios, as ever, George Reynolds. So that's just one of the many letters, and this is an unusual letter because most of the letters are filled with so much activity, especially on Mother's end and on his end. So I find it interesting that in March of 1944, which would have been about halfway into the war, there seems to be this undecisiveness about where you're going to serve, what you're going to serve, and are you leaving where you are? And so I thought from that standpoint, this letter was interesting because the rest of the letters are certainly not that way. I mean, they're interesting in a different way. And I thought it was interesting historically because the senator from North Carolina had considered running for president. And
I was going to go back and ask you, you know, you mentioned before about your mother not really talking about being a pilot, mm-hmm. But after she began telling stories and meeting her friends and you caught the bug about finding out about it, do you have any indications about what interested her about aviation? You know, what?
Well, yes, of course. Her father was started with Eastern Transport, as I'd mentioned in her biography. So she grew up in aviation. Eddie Rickenbacker was her dad's best friend.
So that when you mentioned that before, that was family life.
A little girl.
Yeah.
Sure, that's what they did. And you know, now that I reflect back, I've been to many an air show. And I just thought she liked going to these air shows. I mean, I remember since I was a little girl. Oh, there's an air, you know, the Blue Angels are coming Tallahassee.
Oh boy!
Well, guess what? We were going to the air show. I've been to a lot of air shows with her.
But you didn't understand the significance until
she
later.
She liked airplanes. That's pretty much it. That's mm-hmm. right. Right until much later, and I don't know if my older sister they're 5 or 6 years older than I am. And I don't know if she had an opportunity to do that with them as much as she did with me because mm-hmm. I was coming in on the tail end.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard mm-hmm. to carry 5 with you. It's easier just to carry 2. when I was really exposed to it, she used to go to the reunions.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a big deal to her. And certainly when she moved here, when they had reunions, she went. And I have an entire folder of reunion pictures.
Mm-hmm.
And they were very significant to her. And I, like I said, she had friends all over Florida who had been former WASP.
Sure.
So I realized that was the girls' club.
Yes. Now, what kinds of activities, when she was first assigned something, now what would be her job? What plane did she fly, and what was its purpose?
Well, they were all trained on several different aircraft, and then she was sent to Chico and then mm-hmm. Bakersfield, but she towed targets.
I heard you mention that.
Yes, and she ferried aircraft.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Apparently, she did some administrative work because they would send her ahead. And it may be just because she was in an earlier class
mm-hmm.
that, you know, they had her trained and they would just send two of them out there together. And they didn't usually have a ride or didn't know where they were staying. So that's when they'd have to call Ms. Cochran and say,
yes,
we're here.
Now, what did she tell you of Ms. Cochran? Did she...
Oh, she was quite a sport. Absolutely. And that's the picture of her with Ms. Cochran that we did earlier.
Yes.
What a wonderful person. To gather all these girls together from all over the United States and put them in a Venture Field. I mean, a Venture Field, the barracks didn't look as nice as you see in these pictures. It was pretty bad.
I'm sure.
And she had to, you know, she had to ask for money, Ms. Cochran did, and mm-hmm. supplies, and some women's clothes, which the Army didn't make.
Yes.
So they had to adapt. And I think perhaps that difficult, that angle brought some humor to the girls. They were all in the same boat.
And certainly made them closer.
Right.
They were facing the same challenge.
Exactly. And I do have a beautiful picture, and I have it on the CD, of a whole group of them sitting there praying to the plane. You know, because that was their that was what they were supposed to be doing.
Yes.
I think it was actually pretty difficult, the whole thing that they did there. I do have something that she had told me about, and that is there was another airfield around there pretty close by, and once those guys got wind that there were girls at Avenger Field, then Saturday nights they would invite them over, and they would all have steak dinner and dance.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
So that was nice.
Did she ever talk about, now I know they weren't fully recognized as far as pilots or service people, you know, they were kind of on the fringe and beginners, but did she talk about any overt personal discrimination that she felt?
Absolutely. These women were discriminated against,
certainly.
First and foremost. After putting themselves out there, they really didn't know what they were putting themselves out to. 25,000 applicants or how many applied.
Yes.
I believe that 1,700 got through that process, 17,000, but only 1,200 graduated.
That's what I read.
Yes. So, and there was definitely discrimination. There is discrimination today.
Of course.
They
were trying to do their duty.
Called them to work, called them to come and serve their country, to free up pilots so that the pilots didn't have to ferry or tow targets for other male pilots. They could send them overseas and the women could do their job. Nancy Cochran convinced Hap Arnold that she could train these women,
mm-hmm.
and she did,
and she trained
them very well.
Yes.
So they served their country. They stepped up to the plate, and these few women made it,
mm-hmm.
Without any recognition. When it was over, they just went home and started.
Did she ever sound resentful or hurt by any of that?
I think many of the women went home and didn't talk about it again. I think they really just kept it inside. There was a different life at home. They would go back to their parents, perhaps their boyfriend's parents. And we know how many weddings happened after that. Where did I put that picture? Oh. For example, this was my father,
mm-hmm.
when he was in the Air Force. And when they came back, this is the picture of them married November 2nd, 1945.
Mm-hmm.
There were a lot of weddings in 1945.
Yeah.
And so there were a lot of babies being born.
Uh-huh.
And I think they just fell into the total, I'm in the family now. And it was supposed to be sort of a top secret experiment anyway, because if it had failed,
I see.
They didn't want to be exposed.
Yes. Yeah.
So the girls really went home not knowing what to say.
Yes.
What do they say?
Well,
they were told not to say anything.
They
weren't recognized. You know,
Where did their families think they were? Did they?
Oh, well, they knew because they would get home letters from them. But the Army was not going to recognize this.
And so they quietly put their memorabilia away in trunks and stashed it in the closet while they raised a family, mm-hmm. and became American wives and mothers.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And I'm so grateful to my mother and the other women who knew what a treasure the experience was. And they kept these things maybe for a long time just for themselves.
Yeah. Maybe they would go through them sometime,
sure.
when no one was around.
Right. And don't you know that in the back of their closet was always that uniform and that jumpsuit?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. So it was something they would come across quite often, and it would spark I'm sure, memories.
And to think that how important those reunions became then later when they did get together.
So important. Oh, the pictures I have. These ladies are just such validation
of who they were, mm-hmm. and what they contributed.
And when Mother was Region 1 director and she wanted to hold a reunion here, mm-hmm. in Fernandina, she shared with me, we were very, very close, and she said, I'm just so sad. So many of the women don't have money to travel. You have to remember, they had no benefits. They were not, no hospital benefits, no veterans benefits, no pension.
No acknowledgement.
And they had, you know, they were getting on up in their years, 70s,
sure.
80s.
Maybe widowed.
Sure. Mother was feeling, even though in 1978, what Congress did was they acknowledged them. But they need to do more. Mm-hmm. And it's being worked on. I personally feel like I need to go back to Washington.
Maybe so. Maybe that's in your future.
Because they're still very much out there. As I attended the Wings of Dreams in Keystone Heights, and six of the WASP attended as well, mm-hmm. And did a great program. I think that the ladies that are left, if there's ever a time for them to save, for Congress, or for the United States to save face, this is it.
Yeah.
Just do the right thing.
Well, you obviously were very close to your mother because of a lot of reasons, but then coming across this and having this whole other world of respect for, mm-hmm. her, what's the major thing you feel like you've taken away from this experience and sharing it with other people? What has it done for you?
Oh, a total appreciation of women in the military and the struggles that they continue to go through today. And I don't want to elaborate on this, but I actually was at an event where I was supposed to do an oral speech, and it was a hangar full of bombers, men and stuff, and the person in charge had been a fighter pilot in World War II, and I sat dutifully on the front row, my little piece of paper, and I had a whole display, many people had come by to see it, waiting for my name to be called, and he just ended the program and never called on me. And I felt the first time in my life what my mother must have felt. A million times. And I was so angry and so hurt. I didn't have a hissy fit. I marched right up over there. I found out who their wives were. And I went and had a little chat with them. And they said I had no idea.
Yeah.
Boy, Albert's in trouble now.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, I tried to use my sense, my brain. You know, I don't need to talk to these men. They've already decided they were not going to acknowledge the women Air Service pilots of World War II. They weren't going to do it. After I've already been approved, I'm in the program. I didn't understand this. Oh, they chose to do this. So I spoke to their wives about it, and they apologized, and they were regretful, and they were unaware.
Yes, yes.
So, but I felt for the first time what I know these women have probably felt
many times.
Yes. Sure.
Yeah.
And I thought, my goodness, this would be very stressful if I felt this very much more.
Yes.
So I do programs. If someone wants a program done, I do.
Well, and you've got such a wonderful and a personal story to tell. Mm-hmm. Julia, I just can't thank you enough for sharing all of this, all of your memorabilia and your stories and everything. Is there something else that we need to add before we close
out?
Well,
I think you've done a thorough job, Anne.
I hope so.
I appreciate you coming down, and Deborah.
We have certainly enjoyed it, and I think we're going to savor these tapes and the pictures and everything when we get back and begin to do our editing process.
Well, I thank you for that, and I would like to encourage everyone, if they haven't been to Washington, the Veterans Women's Memorial is up through November, and that's the first time that they are actually featuring the Women Air Service pilots there. So if you get that way, that'd be a good thing to go see.
That's wonderful.
And I thank you both so much.
Thank you.